Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books in Buddhism, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Kate Hartman, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Bill Gorveen, associate professor at Hendricks College, about his new book, Envisioning a Tibetan Luminary, The Life of a Modern Bunpo Saint, out this year from Oxford University Press. Bill Gorveen, welcome to the show. Yes, it's so great to talk about this wonderful new book. So just to start us off, Bill, I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself and how you came, to the study of religion, to the study of Bun, and then to the specific work that motivated this project.
I would say that, the story, just like in the lives of saints, although I wouldn't want to put myself anywhere near that category, in Buddhism, you never know which former life to go back to, to begin the tale. Unfortunately, I don't have the knowledge to be able to go that far back. But within the framework of this life, I think the decision to study abroad in college is probably the biggest one that I made. I was fortunate enough to do the University of Wisconsin-Madison College Year in India program. I just kind of went with what they recommended at the time. I was interested in Hinduism and Indian mythology and yoga and possibly Sanskrit. And I thought I might try to go to Varanasi, but I think they needed people for the South India program. And they convinced me to learn Telugu and to go to Vishakhapatnam, which where they used to have a campus back in the late 80s and early 90s. When I was in Madison for the summer doing Telugu, I met some people who were studying Tibetan, with Geshe Sopa at that time in a summer intensive and doing the College Year in Nepal program, and became friends with one of them. And when my program was over, I decided to travel around and went and visited people at their program house in Kathmandu and Boda. That was my first real connection with Tibetans in exile, and was really fascinated, kind of taken by what I saw going on there. My kind of encounter with Buddhism from a, in-person perspective. I'd taken a course in Buddhism in college prior to that. But in any case, I had some interest in sort of Kagyu and Nyingma traditions, eventually decided I wanted to try to pursue that in graduate school. And when I did so, I moved to Virginia, where I did my PhD in the mid-90s, around 93, actually. And it was the very same summer that I was starting Summer Tibetan that a Bun Lama moved to Charlottesville at the same time. And that's Tenzin Wangyal, who is now quite well known, founded the Lignancha Institute for bringing Bun to the West, America and Europe. And so I didn't really know anything about Bun prior to that time, but his teacher, Yongzhen Rinpoche, Yongzhen Tenzin Namda, came at the same time that very first summer in Virginia and was teaching Dzogchen, which is when I learned that the Bun tradition had Dzogchen. And he was teaching from a text that was actually authored by Shardza Tashi Gyaltsen, who ended up becoming the subject of this book. After meeting them and kind of having sort of Bun suddenly is my almost my literal next door neighbor as a grad student in Charlottesville, I thought, hey, there isn't as much research done on Bun as there seems to be in other Tibetan lineages. And I have these connections now, you know, maybe I could go scout out some sort of pre-dissertation field work or figure out what kind of I could do in Bun studies. And initially I thought I would do a project related to Dzogchen tradition or, you know, practice texts or philosophical texts or something. I went to Eastern Tibet, ended up finding a Bun community, and discovered that the work they were doing there was also based on some of the writings of Shardza. Again, I could probably tell you even more about these stories, but that's the kind of the beginnings anyway of how I started moving towards this project.
Mm-hmm. Just, you know, encountering the works of Shardza everywhere you went, sounds like.
Yeah.
So, you know, as I said at the beginning, this is the channel on Buddhist studies, but your work is about Bun. So perhaps not everyone listening to the channel knows so much about Bun. Could you perhaps give, you know, just a brief overview of what Bun is, how it relates to Buddhism, for some of those listeners?
Yeah, it's true. And I suppose I could plug the book a little bit for people who would like to know more. I was encouraged to try to do some of that very thing in the first chapter. You know, because, yeah, you can't really assume, I mean, many people, myself included, who have an interest in Buddhism or in Tibetan, you know, religious culture, you know, may have encountered Bun as perhaps even as the sort of nemesis of figures like Milarepa or early Buddhism or Padmasambhava. You know, is Bun the native tradition of Tibet that is sort of an impediment to the spread and diffusion of Buddhism in early Tibet? And indeed, at times, you know, it's represented as such. And I think there have been, you know, a history of at times strained relationships between these kind of emerging lineages in Tibetan history. But there's other ways also to think about, you know, the tradition. If it isn't the kind of, you know, the rival of the early Buddhists, it's sometimes styled as the indigenous religion of Tibet, which, you know, there's some basis for that. But then if you actually talk to the Bunpos about their own history, they'll tell you that they originated in lands to the west of the Tibetan plateau. So in some sense, we could see them as also a kind of a tradition that spread and diffused and came into Tibet from somewhere else. So it may not be quite native in the same way. I think, you know, if we try to boil it down to a sort of a nutshell, we can say that the tradition preserves certain ritual traditions, certain, you know, understandings of particular deities that are unique, kind of different from what you might find in Tibetan Buddhist lineages. But on the other side, they've kind of been in cultural dialogue now for over a millennia, and that there are, you know, higher teachings or teachings pertaining to liberation in Bun tradition that are, you know, very old at this point. And I think you find a kind of a lot of parallels. People like Perkaverna has written about that in terms of monasticism, monastic discipline, you know, the notions of liberation, the path to liberation, philosophical studies, you know, notions of emptiness and, you know, and bodhicitta and all of this. And in particular, you know, there's a lot in common with the Nyingma tradition when it comes to teachings about the nature of mind. And, so they have the great perfectioner Dzogchen as the kind of pinnacle of their system of vehicles, or, you know, as the ultimate view and so on. And they have Tantra as well. And again, some of the, you know, Buddhist polemicists asserted or insisted that these materials were sort of plagiarized versions of Buddhist texts. But I think some of the scholarship has shown that the kind of intertextual relationships over time have been really complicated. And it's not always clear, you know, what preceded what and what influenced what. And some of the death rituals and other things are, you know, that we find in Tibetan Buddhism may owe something to Bun, you know, predecessors and so forth. So the tradition that I got to know is is what some would call the reformed Bön tradition, or what the Bönpos themselves call Yungdrung Bön, or eternal Bön, which, you know, really was sort of consolidated, you know, beginning in what, the 11th century, and certainly by the 15th century, you have these, you know, a kind of a monastic and textual tradition that is well established in ways that are, you know, analogous to other lineages. And so, you know, a lot of my time on the project was at the headquarters, the kind of monastic seat of Bön, known as Menri Monastery, which formerly was, you know, in central Tibet. So someone who wasn't interested in the nuances of Tibetan lineages kind of wandered through northern India and showed up in this community, they might very well assume they're at a Buddhist monastery. It just so happens that some of the deities and some of the ritual traditions and kind of, you know, commentaries and other things that they read are different. You know, I think that could be an area for, you know, people to further explore, you know, what's Bön's unique take on emptiness and so forth for the philosophers and scholastics out there. There's, you know, some of that's been done, but there's always more. Perhaps it's less well known than some of the other stuff.
Yes, it certainly does seem that Bön sometimes just gets cast as this, you know, other minority thing in Tibetan religions, and we don't super think too much of it, except that it's, you know, just cast as this other, or sometimes as this changeless or timeless thing. When I think one of the, you know, certainly the key benefits of your book is to examine sort of the dynamics of Bön, and that it's changing and it's interacting with Buddhism in interesting ways. I'll echo your plug from earlier to say that I think this book gives one of the best sort of accessible introductions to the Bön tradition. So listeners who, of course, should read the whole book may want to even just excerpt that part of for use in teaching classes.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. I hope so. You know, that was something that felt a little daunting to take on. Oh, how do I kind of summarize a tradition and, you know, in one chapter? I'm sure there's plenty of things that I've left out that, perhaps could be mentioned there, but I hoped it would be accessible enough to a non-specialized audience. And I was happy. Even my my older sisters, who were proud that I was able to come out with this book and who know nothing about Tibetan religion, I think they were able to make it through the first chapter.
Nice.
At least, right? Without too much pain. Yeah.
Sure, our students also appreciate that, you know, the book has been tried and tested on a kind of non Buddhist studies specialist audience and been found helpful.
That's true. Yeah, nobody complained about it on course evaluations too much. When this was in progress, I did subject it to some
Excellent.
Undergrads at a liberal arts college. So that was my hope that it would.
I think it's very
successful
on that front. And so turning to the subject of the book as a whole, Shardza Tashik Yeltsin, can you tell us a little bit about him, who he is, you know, what compelled you to write this book about him?
Sure. Well, you know, as I kind of mentioned initially, I probably had more interest in, you know, in the Dzogchen tradition as a whole. You know, my advisor, David Germano, is, you know, known for having a lot of expertise about the Nyingma Dzogchen tradition. And of course, there'd been work on that by, you know, others like Janet Gyatso, and talking about Jigme Lingpa. And, you know, there was one book on Bön Dzogchen by Sumtin Karme. And so I really thought, oh, okay, you know, one of the things that Shardza is known for is for, you know, being a kind of fairly contemporary, kind of modern day proponent of Dzogchen. But it wasn't Shardza specifically that I was kind of aiming to do a project on. But as I mentioned, I found that, you know, some of the Dzogchen being taught to Western audiences by, you know, Bön authorities owed to his writing. And then when I got to Eastern Tibet, I discovered that some of the, you know, the trainings that, you know, sort of contemplative nuns were doing was also based on his writing. And so then my next thought was, well, I'd like to do my field work with the exile community in India, in Manri. Let me explore, you know, how they may be applying shards of Dzogchen materials. And when I got there with that in mind, this was kind of what I got funding for. I quickly discovered that, his writing was not going to be sort of singled out and promoted as, you know, the most important or as particularly essential. There's even perhaps some sense in which it shouldn't take pride of place in the curriculum in Manri, the kind of, you know, the headquarters of Bun. And I was a little surprised. I thought, okay, so, they don't read Shardza. And then as I kind of asked around, I found out that, like, well, you know, actually, you know, his material is very accessible and we will look at it, you know, as a supplement. But, you know, their job was to preserve older Dzogchen material and to make that primary. And in kind of finding out about this, I discovered that there had been some controversy over whether Shardza had been kind of sufficiently orthodox enough, and that there had been people, you know, in the history of Menri and other central Tibet monasteries who, had some questions and doubts, and in fact, some controversy had developed about whether, you know, Shardza's material was, had kind of strayed too far, had become too ecumenical, too rime, and was in some sense too informed by Buddhist approaches or terminology or whatnot. And so this then became, a kind of an important thing to investigate. And I thought, well, you know, how did all of this happen? And I decided my first order of business was to kind of learn more about, you know, his life history and how it was that he had some of these relationships that may have led to his work being, the subject of some doubt on the part of authorities in Menri.
He's simultaneously this sort of central figure, and
exactly.
Yet there's marginal. This interesting controversy around him that he perhaps represents.
Exactly. I wanted to know, like, why somebody who I expected
that,
to be central,
you know, and what's the story behind
these very different Bun communities I'd wandered into, you know, he was lauded, and there was no question that his work was accessible, and it was a source of blessings, and, you know, it was clear, and in fact, he's reported to have attained the rainbow body. He is a Jalupa, which is, you know, one of the more interesting things about him, and one of the things that makes him famous. I also discovered that, you know, in Western scholarship, he was especially celebrated as a kind of the main Bun contributor to the nonpartisan movement in Eastern Tibet, to the Rime movement. And so I kind of expected him to just be celebrated wherever I found him. And then I get to, you know, the headquarters of Bun, and there's some sense in which people are like, yeah, okay, but, and kind of, you know, there was a little bit of a different sensibility there. And as you just summarized for me, that's kind of what led me to kind of want to explore his life history and life story. And thus the biography ended up becoming the focus for the project.
Yeah. And so so you mentioned the Rime movement and the sort of changes that are happening in Tibet during the time Shardza is living. So what, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what life is like when Shardza is born and when he's active. What is the sort
sure.
of environment?
Well, it's,
religiously,
you know, it's interesting. I started to become curious to, you know, also try to get a sense for how did this figure kind of rise to prominence, and what kind of things contributed to his career as a religious figure, and, you know, and eventually one who was embroiled in some controversy. Would these texts tell me that, and in what way? And that's one thing that, you know, we could talk more about is the genre a little bit as well. To what degree can we read these as histories, as a source for, you know, understanding this period of Tibet's past, or to what degree are they also kind of idyllic, inspirational stories, you know, or perhaps even political acts, right, that would position him, you know, in a certain way amidst the landscape. So I think I was both a kind of a hopeful reader, but maybe also a cautious one in terms of trying to understand, you know, what it can tell us. But I think, you know, our field has you know, come to recognize that we really can discern some interesting features of local history through these texts, that they're not just kind of, giving us sort of cardboard two-dimensional characters who are saints, and, you know, here's our three-page story about his life. Instead, you know, we have in the longer of these of two texts that talk about Chartres, and we've got, you know, 600 pages of detailed documenting of places visited and so forth. But circling back to his environment, he was born in a rural area, a place called Zakok. So Chartres is Eastern Za, which is in Kham in Eastern Tibet. And it's, I think it's in the, if I remember, the kind of a fairly remote part of Kham, near the Dachu River. I have not visited the place where his hermitage was or his home monastery, but I understand you still have to walk a ways to get there. It's still not so accessible by road. He was not born to a family of any real rank. It didn't seem as though he had any particular advantages or particular dynamics that would have kind of predisposed him to a religious career. He wasn't recognized as a tulku, and he didn't have an uncle or someone who was, you know, in the monastery. And in fact, he was the only son of his parents, which, you know, at first he seems to, according to the story, express some interest in taking vows, you know, as a young person. A number of his sort of schoolmates or his peers were doing so, and his parents really didn't want him to get too involved. And at one point, he starts to show signs of disturbance, which maybe, you know, he's acting out in a particular cultural idiom. It can also be a sign that the protector deities were kind of intervening because he was a person with kind of special karma to do this work. It's a kind of, you know, religious vocation, if you like. But his parents resisted his initial efforts. And, you know, they probably would have liked to have passed the family property on to him and had him carry on the line. But a local lama who kind of shows up as a sort of tantric adept and a ritual specialist, basically tells them, look, there's no other way. You know, if your kid doesn't become a monk, you know, he's not going to be of any help to you. He's not going to be useful. So you should do it. So the reluctant parents allowed that, but this is the beginning for him, really, learning to, you know, perform rituals, you know, with a teacher in a local community, perhaps, you know, helping what Jeffrey Samuel called the pragmatic orientation, right, of Tibetan village religion, help with keep the animals healthy and the crops growing and the hail away and the rain coming on time.
These are very important things to make sure someone qualified as taking care of them. Yeah. And so, yeah, perhaps I should have asked about this first, but you mentioned, how do we know any of these things, that there are two biographies or hagiographies that form the sort of core of the sources informing this book. So maybe could you tell us about these, a little bit more about these two biographies or hagiographies or life stories?
Sure. They're both written by the same author, one of his disciples. So, and it's actually kind of helpful that the author in the longer of the two, what's called the what I call the comprehensive, or the kind of gepa, the expanded version of the life. He takes some time to kind of reflect openly and reflexively about the nature of his project and what he thinks a biography ought to be, and what it shouldn't be, and so forth. And you know, both of them intend to sort of foster faith in disciples or engender confidence, right, in themselves and their lineage. But it, you know, one of them, the expansive one, also is a kind of curriculum vitae, in the sense that it really does try to chart out and document accomplishments in a rather detailed chronological sort of a way. It is a kind of a chronicle, and you know, with occasional quite interesting authorial commentary that is the kind of stuff that at times gets my attention as a reader. And then this is contrasted with a condensed, or a kind of a dordu, a kind of abridged biography, which the translation of which constitutes the second part of the book. And that's kind of, I suppose, a funny story. I didn't really think I was going to do a translation. I really just wanted to get a sense for his life. But the abbot of Menri was kind enough to appoint a young scholar to work with me on the translation of this, or on my research. And he was a wonderful partner to do this work with. His name is Drukse, or Drukse Jigme Tenzin. And he was so methodical and careful that when we were reading, like, we really were discussing like grammar, you know, from the get-go. And, well, this is an honorific verb, so, you know, can't be talking about himself there, and you know, really trying to parse it in detail, and then to look up reference and stuff, and we were going so slow that I thought, you know, if I'm taking note, I might as well just start producing the translation. So that's what we did. But this shorter version that we worked on is more of a provides a more stylized image, a more thematic presentation of an ideal life. And so I would say that one is closer to a kind of hagiography. You know, it kind of talks about his life according to a series of categories that I think give you a sense for what this author thinks an ideal life should have, you know, should include. So I translated that one, and then I read and, you know, jotted down notes, kind of did a briefer skim through of the comprehensive version. And then my own kind of portrait tries to combine the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these, you know, so the study of these hagiographies has been a focus in Tibetan studies for a while, insofar as these are often our primary source of information about these wonderful figures. And yet we're both aware of the kind of textual project of inspiration, of motivation, you know, of turning this person into a model to be followed, and yet also wanting to be interested in, you know, what do they tell us? How do we read them as scholars? And so you alluded before to saying that these hagiographies aren't giving us these two-dimensional cardboard cutouts. So how would you say that you were, you know, reading these sources or approaching these sources?
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting, you know. I mean, I guess in my own mind, or one of the things that I had always in the background was some of this sort of oral history that I collected in the Bund settlement, and it was wonderful that, you know, I think things were at enough of a historical distance that whatever controversy had ensued during and after Shards's lifetime about his status vis-a-vis the Bund orthodoxy. In other words, you know, was he orthodox enough, or, you know, or who took what side in perhaps some rather nasty correspondence that circulated in the Bund world about these things. All of that was far enough in the past by, you know, the time I came to this project, that many people in the Bund community were open in talking about it with me. You know, there wasn't a feeling as though these wounds are still fresh, we can't talk about these fissures or fractures that had afflicted our community. I think, you know, given the exile experience and everything that happened in the second half of the 20th century, you know, in Tibet, that this stuff was small change. And so, you know, His Holiness, you know, the 33rd Menri Chidzin, the abbot and head of Bun at the time, was telling stories about these things, and many other senior lamas also would. And they themselves had, you know, their teachers had been involved in writing some of this correspondence criticizing Shardza. You know, but the abbot himself told me that his teacher later spent time in Eastern Tibet and read some of Shardza's material firsthand and actually changed his mind and kind of became convinced that it had merit. And so he received a favorable opinion of Shardza himself, but was aware of, you know, that many of the senior people had teachers who may have been on one or the other side in this sort of debate about whether Shardza was to be trusted or not. And so because I had those that kind of oral history in mind, it kind of gave me a lens or an angle to kind of think about the representation that I was sort of consuming as or encountering as a reader. You know, in other words, is this, you know, and at times there's things that might feel fairly kind of generic qualities that you would want a Buddhist figure of any kind of lama to have. You know, is he motivated by, you know, concern for the welfare of others? Well, yes, he is, you know, of course. You know, is he disillusioned with, you know, worldly affairs in some way? Well, yes, he is, you know. And occasionally there may be some nuance in there that adds a little bit of extra subtlety or texture that we can appreciate. And at times it may be fairly kind of pedestrian, right, in the way it's related and, you know, fits the profile. But for me, I could also along the way be wondering, oh, if he's emphasizing his fidelity to monastic precepts or to, you know, the old Menri traditions and texts and so forth, is that partly in order to appease this segment of his audience, you know, that we know was suspicious about that particular question, let's say. And, so that kind of thing helped me to read it in a way that, you know, gave me things to look for here and there, as I was otherwise kind of, you know, letting the image kind of wash over me, let's say, as a reader.
Yeah, so as you're reading these texts, which present this kind of perfected portrait of this figure, you're also aware that there's an ongoing controversy about his place in the tradition. And so it kind of helps you. One of the really interesting things about the book is that you're reading these hagiographies to say, you know, what objections or suspicions, as you just said, are they anticipating on the part of potential audiences, and how are they kind of, you know, going out there and presenting Shardza in such a way as to address those concerns.
Yeah, I really did feel, I mean, I've read that, you know, they talk, and again, other people, senior scholars in Tibetan studies have talked about the fact that these, you know, perform a kind of a political function amidst a competitive sectarian environment among, you know, and that certainly makes sense, you know, that they may be trying to, again, develop a sense of confidence in a figure, but sometimes that, you know, that may be required or necessary if there are those in the world who lack confidence in that figure. But I think, you know, rather than seeing it, but it, you know, to say that doesn't mean that it's, I don't know, it's the result of some sort of scheming and this sort of machinations, that it's all part of a political calculus. I think that there can be these a lot of things can be happening at once. I mean, I think that it's certainly also an act of faith on the part of a disciple to represent his teacher in terms that are quite devotional, really, and indeed, you know, the text is read sometimes on retreat, you know, by people who are undertaking Shardza's preliminary practices, you know. And that they really do help to, you know, motivate students in that traditional way. And yet, I also think it could be trying to create, you know, an image, a kind of literary image that would that would create community, we could say, that would maybe even heal divisions, or might not necessarily be about, you know, beating out some other political rival, but rather simply trying to kind of create a sort of harmonious image that everyone could embrace. I think I see it sort of along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you say that in the introduction that we can see this these two biographies as having, you know, three either explicit or implicit goals, namely the inspiration and engendering confidence on the part of disciples, addressing these potential concerns of a suspicious audience, but then imagining a community, and in the process of writing, perhaps helping create such a community where these rifts in the Bun community between old Bun and new Bun, between ecumenical, more monastic, that this text helps imagine, you know, a community in which those rifts are kind of minimized and healed and, you know, brought together.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And, you know, again, it's hard to know how it was received at the time, like whether it was successful. You know, I'm not sure in a way that may be, you know, perhaps ambitious, right, on his part, or to imagine that in that period that, you know, those who were already embroiled in the controversy would have been persuaded. But it does seem as though, you know, a generation or two removed. And I think, you know, this, in some sense, this is the definitive portrait of Schartzer. And he does seem to be remembered in these terms. And again, I think lots of other, as we know, you know, terrible circumstances in Tibet, maybe rendered some of these things moot, but at least in the present day, it seems as though it's, you know, perhaps it's succeeded, if not in its original moment in time, then, you know, within a few generations.
Yeah, and I love that the book does present, you know, an investigation of these literary works that's aware of the kind of multiple dynamics playing out, the potential work that it's doing, what it's trying to do. I really love that. So we've alluded generally to Schartzer being controversial or potentially mired in this rift between communities. Perhaps we could flesh that out a bit and say, what are the different poles of potential parties that are talking about Schartzer? You know, what things are going on in the Bun community when he is active?
Yeah, well, you just helpfully mentioned the terms old Bun and new Bun, and that may be a good place to start. You know, there's I think there's this sense that, you know, the kind of the ecumenical movement that, you know, we label Rime, that was active primarily in Eastern Tibet. This may be a good way, I think, by analogy with what was happening in Tibetan religious history more generally, was probably replicated, you know, kind of in miniature among Bunpo. That's sort of what I argue, that there is a kind of distinctive differences between what was happening in Central Tibet under the Gelugpa administration, you know, in 18th, 19th century, you know, vis-a-vis what was happening with non-Gelugpa schools and religious figures in Eastern Tibet in the same period. And in particular, it seems as though in Central Tibet, things like monasticism and monastic purity and scholasticism, you know, monastic debate, you know, that approach was important. Consolidation of knowledge, you know, textbook style approach to learning. Some of these things people have said was, you know, Gene Smith has argued, right, is associated with the Gelug tradition in Central Tibet, as they kind of consolidated authority, and that there was a kind of, in Eastern Tibet, there, you know, you didn't have the same kind of political authority. You had, you know, a lot of kind of people operating with more autonomy. You know, you have other kind of religious characters, or, you know, types of religious specialists who are, you know, non-monastics, let's say, who are operating. You have, you know, treasure discovery, for example, Tertön, or treasure revealers, who have charisma, who are able to kind of disclose and bring out, you know, new new traditions for practice, new commentaries being authored on seminals, texts. So it seems in Berne you have some of the same thing. You have a new treasure phenomenon in new, and this term new Berne, again, I talk about it a little bit in the book. It could be traced back earlier than this period by a couple of centuries at minimum, maybe to the beginning of the 18th century, or depending on how you count certain figures who associated with this movement, you could go back earlier as well. But it seems to have picked up some pace, in Eastern Tibet alongside of the developments in Buddhist lineages. And that I think those questions, how much do you revere or give sort of pride of place to new dharmas and new tertons, to that style of religious authority? Do you care about things like monastic precepts or the transmission of things even like chanting styles, that have come down through mm-hmm. families, family lineages in central Tibet? I think some of it may be economics. I did once ask, one senior monk who was affiliated with a monastery that was sometimes openly accepted the term new Berne as a positive thing in Kham. And he said, if it weren't new Berne, there probably would have been something else, that caused some sense of rivalry or, that could be potentially divisive, and at times that may be that there's scarce resources, that there's not strong Berne patrons or sources of support or revenue in central Tibet. So for those institutions to maintain themselves, they often needed to draw resources from populations in Eastern Tibet. And so, there's a bit of that issue of competition for patrons that may have also been kind of underlying these dynamics.
Yeah, this, it's interesting insofar as Berne, of course, has its own specific ways that these conflicts get read out, but this sort of what we might say more conservative, preserving the past, sort of more institutional monastic hierarchy versus this kind of less monastic, less controlled, new dharmas, new texts, new kinds of things, and the push pull of who's going to, have the say to say what Berne is, I think, going to be familiar to a lot of people studying religion elsewhere. Yes, and so this controversy, I think, can be summed up, not summed up, but there's a funny, I think funny anecdote that you tell in the book called the Sherup Drakpa affair that kind of brings all of these, vague tensions and conflicts really out into the open. So I was wondering if you could just tell that that story for us.
Sure. And, and again, I'm happy to remember that. I heard versions of this from a couple of, senior figures in Menri, but it's nice to remember His Holiness, the 33rd Menri Chidzin, told me this story himself, so I'll try to remember. And he did it with a sense of humor. And, it does go to, Tibetans themselves, even the ones who participate in these, ceremonial protocols that they, spend a lot of time investing in, and it can be very special ritual occasions and so forth, they know very well they're also subject to very human dynamics. And in this one, it's really a little bit about status. And so the story goes, when Shardza was 63, so somewhat later in life, he was invited to a place called Tokdengun. And that's the colloquial term for it. I've actually forgotten the formal name of the monastery, but it's in the book. It's located in Amdo Ngawa, and very near a monastery known as Nangshi or Nangshik, which is much larger. And they're kind of they've traditionally been at odds to some degree. They've been a little bit, there's been some rivalry. And Nangshi, even now is one of the largest Bun monasteries in Tibet. And they have a scholastic training program, which is similar to what traditionally was found in central Tibet and at Yungdrung Lane, you know, where you can study towards a Geshe degree and, you know, do debate and so on. That style of training. And again, it's nice to even mention that people, you know, might assume if, you know, Bun is primarily about, you know, more shamanic side of Tibetan religion, people might be surprised to know that they adopted, you know, debate style of education, but indeed they did, and they still do. So Nongshik is more of that style of place. And again, there's been, I think, some sense of rivalry with Tolkien, and there's some history about that that one could look into. So in any case, Shardza had been invited to Tolkien, and a Geshe from the central Tibetan Bun monastery, the old Bun monastery of Yongdrung Ling, known as Sherup Drakpa, had been invited to Nongshik, which is nearby. And since they were both going to be there at the same time, there was a decision made to have a kind of a joint ceremony, and they set up a tent in the open area, you know, between the monasteries, and they set up the thrones. And according to the versions of the story, there was a problem with the throne, with the seating arrangements to begin with. You know, maybe this is no surprise, right? We all know that who sits in front of, you know, ahead of whom says something about your status. And either the throne for Shardza was either slightly higher than or equal in height to that of this Geshe. And the Geshe was not happy about it because, again, he had this type of credential, right? It's equivalent to a PhD, let's say, that Shardza did not have. Shardza never received a kind of formal education in this style. And that's perhaps one of the things that can be held against him, and which I think the biographer has to do some work to sort of overcome. So then there was a question about, you know, who should speak first. And they apparently were politely deferring to one another. Oh, you know, you go ahead. No, you go ahead. In the end, Shardza spoke first, and he reportedly spoke very well, but at the end, he asked a kind of rhetorical question, which, you know, something to the end of, you know, after and as you know, like, you don't have to use a first person pronoun in Tibet. After I'm gone, but I think that the intention was after the teacher is gone, after your lama is gone, when there's no teacher around anymore, you know, who's going to guide you? And the point is, you have to take some responsibility for yourselves. You know, you have to, you know, do your practice and, right, take to heart what you've been taught. You can't be relying on the, you know, the teacher in person all the time. So, you know, he said something like this: after the teacher is gone, who's going to be able to guide you? Apparently, the Geshe understood this differently. And he thought that Shardza was saying something rather proud, which is that after I, Shardza, am no longer here in the area, who's capable of guiding you? And the Geshe took this as a slight. And then apparently, you know, spoke rather argumentatively and talked about, you know, gave a lecture about what was important in the religious life. And it was really about things that would help to maintain and preserve the tradition and vows and study and practice, and then, you know, doing this kind of yogi's own thing, you know, may help you liberate yourself, you know, like a stone, like going up into the sky and, you know, disappearing, but, you know, it doesn't do much for Bun. So, you know, don't be like that kind of person, really. And that was really the model that Shardza represented. So this is the way the story goes. And apparently once there was this kind of falling out between the two of them, that was the flashpoint for a whole series of, you know, rather nasty correspondence, you know, in literary style that circulated among people back and forth over, you know, a number of years from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we as academics wouldn't know anything about these sort of slights and credential pride issues. So
yeah, no, it doesn't sound like anything we experience at all.
No. But it is this, you know, wonderful sort of human moment where you get a sense of this community saying, you know, what types of authority, what kinds of backgrounds, who, you know, again, gets to say what Bun is.
Yeah. It's real, and it's interesting. It does feel like there's resonances for today in a way. You know, on what basis do we have authority to, you know, represent mindfulness or whatever it is? And how do we, you know, what is a meaningful credential? And is it just in the eyes of the audience, or you know, who should have confidence in what they know, and so forth? I think it's, you know, yeah, these are interesting questions. Is it just about kind of maintaining and performing status, or, you know, or what? But yeah, it's interesting to see, you know, in some sense, these maybe rather human dynamics playing out in a very different circumstance. But it was also fun to have, you know, the Menri, you know, authorities telling me these sort of juicy stories, almost like sort of gossiping a little bit about, you know, these, in some sense, you know, probably, you know, people who maybe got, you know, went a little overboard with their, you know, their reactions to these things.
Yeah. And so if, so Sherup Drakpa, he gets this monastic, you know, Geshe degree, that's sort of his claim to authority. What is it that makes Shardza, you know, in the eyes of these biographers and maybe in the eyes of his followers too, what makes him a compelling, you know, potential alternative to that? What's he got going on?
Yeah, I know. I was kind of really, really thinking about that before we talked a little bit. Like, it's pretty interesting that this rural kid, you know, the only son of a kind of farming family with no special connections, ended up becoming such a renowned figure. And it seems like, you know, he was, part of it was that he really did, I think he was a good learner. But he was, you know, he taught himself, essentially. He read texts in the Protector Temple, you know, in the monastery where his teacher, you know, kind of was presiding. And he started writing. I think it was probably the draw to begin writing on the basis of the things he read. And then, you know, he did have esoteric experiences as well, you know, in relationship to his teacher. You know, interestingly, his teacher is kind of styled as a kind of tantric, unpredictable figure, you know, who's able to, through skillful means, including kind of frightening and dangerous skillful means, you know, wake him up to kind of, you know, hidden knowledge that was sort of buried within him. And once he had some of these breakthrough experiences, he was then able to comprehend written material in ways that hadn't been possible before. So some of his religious authority is kind of conveyed through these sort of esoteric means. I think part of it, though, is that he then develops, you know, not only a love for kind of self-study, but also a love and a proficiency for writing. And he starts writing. And then I'd say there's some circumstances. One, too, is that he must have been a really good teacher. You know, the initial story of him teaching was fairly, you know, again, pedestrian is the word that comes to mind. The abbot was going to be away, you know, and basically asked him to substitute, you know, okay, teach preliminary practices to, you know, these people who are showing up. And he was good at it. And so people asked him to do it again, and he began to teach and then do some writing in relationship to students who asked for particular things. So those are some of the things that are coming together. And then the other thing is that there was some unrest in his home region. That might be interesting to talk about, but he became, at that point, he started to travel. And just prior to that, he met a Tertön in the Bun tradition, who became a close friend and really both a teacher and student and a kind of co-collaborator. And I think that the agency of the Tertön, Sanak Lingpa, was really important to the reception he received when he started to travel in Yarong in particular. And that's when he started to receive some real patronage and some of the funds that would support publication of his writing. And once his writing started to circulate from there, he really became, someone to be reckoned with, and a really well-known figure from that point forward.
Yeah, and particularly in this climate, as you've mentioned, of Rime, of people being interested in learning from different sorts of teachers. You mentioned in the book that he does have contact with some, you know, well-known Buddhist teachers, and people are crossing sectarian lines left and right. It's a very interesting time in Tibetan history.
It is. And that, to me, you know, as somebody, again, I, you know, came to Tibet having an interest in Tibetan Buddhism already. And I kind of imagine that some of the readers of a book like this would have familiarity or interest in Tibetan Buddhism. And to me, those kind of the relations with Tibetan Buddhists was something I was certainly curious about. And again, when I had started to read a bit about him in the available scholarship, he was certainly his Rime connections are one of the things that's always mentioned, almost near the beginning, that he's sort of said to be by people like Gene Smith, you know, what Kongtrul and Kensei were for the Buddhists in this period, you know, Shardze is for the Bunpo, a kind of systematizer and someone who participated in this ecumenical climate quite actively. And I was interested in whether the biographer would, how he would handle, that, given that that might be a bit controversial. But in fact, he really celebrates it, I would say. I think he's generally keen to emphasize this sort of nonpartisan attitude as one that's especially laudable and is indeed the kind of ideal quality a religious figure should have. Even amidst this potential critique from more conservative Bunpo. And he takes pains to, in fact, reproduce a letter that Shardze received from Kongtrul, from Dzongkhön Kongtrul Rinpoche. Again, Shardze was quite young. He sent him a letter. Kongtrul was in his 80s, but responded with a kind letter that sort of encouraged Shardze. And then again, as you mentioned, there are several cases that I kind of mention of various relatively prominent Buddhists who receive Shardze or correspond with him or speak highly of his writing. And that's kind of interesting to see.
Yeah. And so, as you've also alluded to, the book, part two of the book, is a full translation of the shorter of these two biographies, which I really appreciate insofar as the kind of analysis presents the material in a certain kind of way. But then you also give us kind of direct access to the text itself, such that, we can read about Shardze in the manner that Kelsang Tembe-Gyaltsen wrote about him. So I do really appreciate that.
Thanks. Yeah, quite honestly, if I had a fear or doubt about the book, I kind of wondered whether it was sort of under-theorized in some sense, and that was maybe my own, anxiety about the project. But I guess I also decided that perhaps it's better to err on that side, given that we all know that sometimes that becomes quickly the more dated aspect of an academic work, if it's really grounded and the theory that seems really kind of what sort of essential for, one decade, it may kind of detract later. I seem to remember a long time ago reading some ethnographic material from the Himalayas that seemed really interesting, but it was read from a kind of psychoanalytic point of view. And I remember kind of just let me get past the analysis so I can read more of the ethnography,
Yeah, I'd love to read those interviews.
Right.
Yeah, so having this kind of direct access to it is, I think, really good, and especially, again, plugging the book as a teaching resource, giving students a sense of what these kind of hagiographies or biographies look like.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, it's quite different. I mean, you know, we wouldn't write it. In some sense, maybe the beginning, you know, the first half of the book is my effort to kind of bridge the gap and kind of retell the story. And I've become the biographer, I suppose, in my own way, and try to highlight the things that I think a Western reader might find interesting. And then you get the traditional one, which has some sections that are really captivating, I think, but then some other stuff that, you know, to me is maybe a little boring. Or, you know, you see that they have it's a big job to kind of try to provide a kind of a resume of accomplishments, let's say, or even lists, you know, of teachers or students or initiations received or something that, you know, in time and place might have been quite important to name. But that for us, you know, maybe less interesting than a captivating narrative about, you know, meditation experience or something. But you get it all. You know, he does his best, I think, for traditional readers to weave it together in a way that makes sense.
Well, I think it's great. I recommend that all of our listeners go out and buy the book. It's available in paperback, so it's, you know, good to assign to students. So, Bill, we've taken up a lot of your time, especially this is the second time we're doing this interview, as the first time the audio got corrupted in some way. So thanks especially for talking with me twice now.
My pleasure, truly.
but before we go, can I ask what you're working on these days? Or what's coming up next for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I'm going to give a talk. I accepted an invitation to give a talk about Bun and Shardza in Korea, actually, a place I haven't been, but kind of excited to talk to an Association of Korean Buddhists about some of this material. And I thought one of the things that that's in Shardza's corpus that some of his readers, some educated readers will know about, is that there's a kind of refutation that he wrote to a Nyingma, a sort of conservative figure from Jarong, who attacked Bun as, you know, as heterodox. And he wrote something that kind of tries to refute some of these charges that were made about, you know, why Bun is incompatible with Buddhism. And it's something that I've looked at before, and I'm going to kind of look back at it again and kind of see, you know, what are some of the ways in which, even in the modern period, there's still some tensions between Bun and Buddhist lineages on certain points, alongside of, you know, again, what are some of the grounds for more productive dialogue, and what are some of the things that seem like common interests or commonly shared. So kind of going to go back and revisit that, which I've looked at before, but not recently, and maybe not in as much depth. Beyond that, we'll have to see. I kind of feel like there's more work that it would be valuable to do, whether by me or by others, you know, with Shards's corpus. There's a wonderful kind of outline overview of it that Jean-Luc Achard has done, so people can kind of dig in and see, you know, his works on Dzogchen, you know, his treasuries. He has so-called five treasuries on a variety of topics. One of them, Samten Karme translated, it was a history of Bun. The Treasury of Good Sayings is extant in English for a Bun history. And so we'll see. You know, working with biographical material has been really rewarding. So there's a biography of one of his foremost students who also attained the rainbow body at the end of his life. So these are all possible areas for further exploration. And I hope that will be done, if not by me, then by others out there with the skills.
Yeah, those all sound like exciting options, and hopefully you get a bit of a break now that the book is out and done before you start.
Yeah, it's been nice
too hard on all of that.
Some vacation time over this past summer for sure.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to just thank you again. Really enjoy it. Recommend the book to all listeners. take care, and I look forward to talking to you again when this new research comes out.